Okay, so what I'll tell you today about is really what we know about the early universe and what we will, what we're hoping to learn about it in the next decade or so. And let me start by just saying that it may not always seem that way, but the universe we live in is actually remarkably simple. And it turns out that the evolution of the universe is described by just a handful of parameters, and we've measured most of those parameters to within a few percent. And maybe this sounds surprising to you or sounds like a strong claim, and so part of the goal of the talk today is to try to explain how, given that if you look at the night sky and you only see a few faint dots in the night sky, we can actually learn so much about the early universe and talk about it with some confidence. This is really a recent or relatively recent development, and so I'll try to really take you through some of the steps that led us to this conclusion, and then I'll tell you a little bit about what else we've learned in a more qualitative way. But so if you look at the night sky, this is not really what you would see of the night sky. This is already showing a lot more stars. If you look outside, you see a few bright dots. So how do we learn anything from them? And the basic feature that really helps us learn about the early universe is that as you look out into the universe, you're actually also looking back in time, because the light travels at a finite speed. And so we can use this. So as an example, if you imagine that you are an astronaut on the moon and you look at the Earth, you don't really see the Earth as it is now. You see the Earth as it is about 1.3 seconds ago. That's not all that much. Not that much changes in 1.3 seconds, but still 1.3 seconds elapse from the time the light here is reflected and when you see it. And the way we know it is because we know the speed of light from just lab measurements, and we know the distance to the moon. There's various ways we know it. One of the ways is just that astronauts left a big mirror there, and we can actually use that mirror to bounce laser beams between the ground and the moon, and so we actually know the distance to within a few millimeters, and so we know how long light takes to travel from the moon to the astronaut on the moon, from the sun, from the Earth to the astronaut on the moon. If you look at the sun, it gets a little bit more interesting. You don't really see, if you look at the sun, obviously you should use shades, you shouldn't just look at the sun, but if you look at the sun with proper equipment, you don't see the sun the way it is now, but you see it the way it was 8 minutes ago. So if you see a solar flare, that flare is not happening now, it happened 8 minutes ago. And that's, again, something we know because we know the size of the solar system. Originally from Venus transits, now we have a lot of space probes that allow us to measure the size of the solar system with great accuracy, so we know how long light travels between us and the sun, and so we look back 8 minutes in this case. That doesn't teach us anything about the early universe, so we'll have to try to figure out how we look further out. Here I'm showing you an example of 61 Cygni, which is a binary star in the constellation Cygnus, which some of you may recognize is down here. So that's the swan that's flying along the Milky Way. You see the wings here, and here in the back of the right wing, this is the 61 Cygni. And it turns out if you look at that binary system, you don't really see it as it is now, but as it was roughly 11.4 years ago. And now you might ask, well, how do you know this one? Because I knew how far it is to the sun, I knew how far it is to the moon. Here it's a little bit less clear how we actually know this. And the way we know the distance to this star is by something that's called a parallax. So that's a basic way of measuring distances. And your brain, in fact, is using this at all times to infer how far an object is from you in a room, or what's further away, what's closer in a room. If you want to do it, not subconsciously, but you want to do it actively, you should look at objects with one eye closed, and then with the other eye closed. You can do it with your finger, because you can easily change the position, and you see that if you look at it with one eye and then with the other eye, the object appears to move. The object doesn't really move, it just appears to move, and it appears to move more the closer it is to you. So the further away the object is, the less it appears to move. Now, you'll see that relatively quickly you run out of eyesight to really measure the distance to objects in this way. So what we do is not really exactly this, but we use essentially the same idea where we observe stars in the night sky, let's say in the fall, and measure the position of that star, typically relative to stars that are much further away. And then we look at the same star in the spring, half a year away, and you see that the star, so this is essentially your right eye, this is your left eye if you want, and so the star appears to have moved by some angle pi, which is called the parallax. And this angle, together with the size of the solar system, which we said we know, allows you to measure how far the star is away from us. So this is how we measure distances to nearby stars. And it's easy to see if you do the same exercise with a star that's closer, that the angle then gets bigger. So we have some way of just measuring this angle, knowing the size of the solar system, to work out how far away stars are from us. And again, this is something, so this is something that we've done now, or the Gaia mission is doing this for a billion stars within our galaxy, so it's very impressive, but it's still limited in the sense that it doesn't really allow us to look far beyond our own galaxy, and so we need other techniques to really measure distances to objects that are further away than stars in our own galaxy. And here, what one of the ways we have been doing this is by using an observation by Henrietta Swan-Leavitt from quite a while ago, so I'm showing you her data here. What she was doing is she was observing variable stars in the Large Magellanic Cloud. Variable just means that they get a little brighter, then they get a little dimmer, so the brightness changes as a function of time in a periodic way. And then here you just, so I'm showing just some of the table. I mean, she observed a lot of them. Here is just a small subset. You see that she carefully numbered the various stars, and then she recorded how bright they are. So the units astronomers use are funny in the sense that smaller numbers means that they're brighter. But so here you see 13.6 for this one. It gets a little dimmer to 14.7. So she recorded the magnitudes, the ranges. And then if you look at these numbers and look at the periods, so she also measured the periods for these stars, then you see that there's a relation. So here, this one has a period of 10 days and a magnitude of about 13.6 here. If you look for another one that has a similar period, let's say this one, it has a similar magnitude, whereas the much bigger one has is brighter. So there's a correlation between the periods of these stars and the magnitudes. And this is so this is something that she pointed out in this paper, and here's a graph, not from the same paper, but another paper, where you see that there's really a good correlation between the period of these objects and their magnitudes. And so this allows you to now look for these types of stars in other galaxies, not in the Large Magellanic Cloud, but in other galaxies. All you have to measure is really the period, and then you know how bright that object should be if it were in the Large Magellanic Cloud. From measuring the magnitude that you see, you can then infer how much further or closer the other galaxy is to us than the Large Magellanic Cloud. So what you're left with is, do you have to measure this, the distance to these objects, let's say with parallax, and then you have an absolute way of measuring distances by using these stars. So that's the way we can, one way we can measure distances to distant galaxies, not too distant. If we want to go even further away, we need brighter objects. I won't really talk about them because they're not too relevant for my talk, but you can use supernova data to look even further out. I'll just show one graph with that. So we can measure the distance in this way. Something else, if we're trying to learn about whether the universe is expanding, contracting, is that we somehow have to understand how we would measure the velocities of these objects. So are they moving toward us? Are they moving away from us? And this is done usually by measuring the spectrum of these objects. So here is an illustration that shows how this is done. So you have a star. You take the starlight through a prism, and then it breaks it up into the different wavelengths. So here you see the spectrum of the star. You see it goes from, I mean, usually the colors of the rainbow. It's the same kind of physics. And then you can measure how bright it is as a function of here frequency. And what you also see is that there are some characteristic lines. So the lines here for the sun are called the Fraunhofer lines because Fraunhofer carefully mapped the lines. And so these features we can use to determine whether a star is moving toward us or away from us. So let's see how that works. So if we have a star that's at rest with respect to us, and say let's looks this way, so there's a few lines at a characteristic frequency, and now you have a star that's moving away from us, then the claim is that the lines for that star will be slightly shifted to the red by an amount that's usually written in this way as 1 plus z, and this quantity z is called the redshift. So you see, if it's positive, the wavelength that you observe for the star is longer than the wavelength that you would observe if the star was at rest. And so now you might ask, why are these lines moving? Why are the frequency? Why is it changing? And the idea is quite similar to something that you're familiar with from sound. So if you look at or listen to a car that's approaching, and then you listen to it when it's moving away from you, you know that there's a difference in the pitch for that car, if you're not. Either the horn, or you can also just hear the engine. I mean, it doesn't have to honk the horn necessarily, but you can also do it with the horn or the siren. But so the idea is you have a higher pitch as it's approaching and then a lower pitch as it's moving away from you. And so this is what allows you to measure the velocity of these objects. That's the basic idea. And you can go back, and this is Vesto Melvin Slipher was doing these measurements early on. That's not really the first paper, but this is some paper by him where he's measuring redshifts of galaxies. So I was showing you stars. There's also features in the spectrum of galaxies, so you can try to measure how far galaxies are, or in this case, people weren't yet sure, so they were called nebulae. And you see that most of them are moving away from us. There's just a few nearby things, it turns out, that are moving toward us. At the time, he didn't know the distance, he just knew the velocities. But so there's a way we can measure both the distances to these objects and the velocities. This is what Hubble did, basically by combining the two techniques I was mentioning. And then the diagram he found was that there's essentially a linear relation, or at least he fit a linear, just a linear function to the data. You might argue maybe this data, you could also fit something else to it, but let's assume that what you should be fitting is a straight line. I'll show you the up-to-date Hubble diagrams. But so here is the distance, and here is the velocity of the redshift, and you see that there's a linear relation between the two, and this is what we usually think as the proof that the universe is expanding. So it's maybe not obvious from the plot, so I want to just give you a simple version of how you want to think about it, or how you understand that there should be a linear relation between velocity and distance in an expanding universe. And it's difficult to really illustrate in our 3+1 dimensional universe. So let's imagine that we live in a lower dimensional universe. You could imagine the surface of a balloon, or because even that was too hard for me to draw properly, let's just imagine that we live on a circle. And then the red galaxy might be the galaxy we live in, the orange galaxy is some other galaxy, and then the blue galaxy is yet some other galaxy. And this is the initial time, this is the size of the universe, is indicated by the radius here of this circle. And then as time goes on, if the universe grows at some later time, it looks like this. Let's say, 100,000 years later, or some time scale later, it looks like this. And you see that the orange point moved by some distance away, the blue point moved by twice that distance away. And because this happened at the same time, the velocities for these two things or the velocity for the blue galaxy relative to the red galaxy is twice as large as for the orange galaxy, and the distance is also twice the distance from the orange galaxy. So you see that there's a linear relationship between the two. You can keep going, you get a picture that looks like this as the universe is expanding out. So I'm showing you snapshots at some different times. And then if you want to write it in terms of equations, you can say that the distance, let's say, between the red and the orange galaxy is given by the size of the radius times the angle between, at least if the angle is small. And similarly, because the only thing that's changing is the velocity, the radius, then the velocity is just given by the time derivative of the radius times the angle, and if you combine them, you see that there's this linear relation where the constant of proportionality is the fractional rate of change of the size of the universe at that time, and because Hubble made these measurements, this is usually called H and called the Hubble constant. So one of the pieces, the way I'm presenting it now, is that we can use the data to learn that the universe is expanding, but we can also turn the equation around, and this gives us now a new way of actually inferring distances to these objects, because all we have to measure now for objects that are very far away, where the recession velocities here are large compared to their intrinsic motion, we can use this formula to measure the distance if we know the velocity which we can get from the spectra. So that's a way we can measure the distance from measuring the redshifts.
Let's see if there's any questions.
Yeah.
We had a question about whether or not the laser pointer can be a different color.
Laser.
It's kind of blinding.
I don't have another one, so this is the one that's here. I don't know.
Can you adjust the intensity?
No, not really.
It's a 19th century laser.
Yeah, so
Science question.
We have a red one or not? No. Any other questions? Yeah.
Which Hubble constant do you use, since there's two distinct values for it?
So for what I'm saying now, for this coarse-grained view, it doesn't really... So if you go back in history, there was a debate whether the Hubble constant is 100 kilometers per second per megaparsec or 50. Now we're significantly better than that, and we're debating whether it's 72 or 68, and so these kind of changes won't really make a difference for what I'm saying. I gave a talk on Friday, a detailed talk about exactly the current Hubble measurements, so in principle I can tell you a lot more about how the different measurements are done and what the subtleties are with the different measurements, but for what I'm saying, really, it doesn't matter. You can think of it as some democratic middle of 70 kilometers per second per megaparsec. Yeah.
And it's still linear.
It's still linear. So eventually, you have to be careful in as you go further out. Eventually, you have to be careful about this. So eventually, the relationship changes. Both the distances, you have to be more careful in general relativity, how you define them.
It's accelerating, isn't it? So it isn't quite linear. The expansion is accelerating, so it isn't quite linear.
So. As I'm saying, so if you go further out, so this is only nearby. If you go further out, you have to be more careful both about what you mean by the distance, or how you define the distance, and about this relation. So there's a generalization that I didn't write on the slides, but there's a version of this formula that holds in general relativity, and that takes that into account.
What distance does that change? At what distance?
Well, so here I'm assuming that this redshift is small compared to 1. So that's the expansion parameter. Sorry?
You mean
this? The redshift, the z quantity, is, I'm assuming, is small compared to 1, which also means that the recession velocity should still be small compared to the speed of light. So that's the expansion parameter. As soon as these objects recede from us at a speed that's comparable or larger than the speed of light, then this formula is no longer true.
This is saying that you need to be careful.
Yeah.
No.
Any other questions? I can write down the full formula if people are interested.
Let's suppose red is the Earth or the Sun, and yellow and blue are two other stars.
Yeah.
The relative velocity there, h0d, is the velocity you would have if those stars had no separate motion of their own, but they were kind of at rest and the space between them just expanded.
Yes, that's what I'm assuming here. So here I'm assuming that I'm really...
But they could also have their own individual velocity.
In general, they will have their own individual velocity, and this is also something that will modify this relation. So this eventually, so there's a typical velocity associated with the intrinsic motion of these objects, let's say a few hundred kilometers per second. So you don't want the redshift to be too large, because otherwise this formula doesn't apply anymore, and you also don't want it to be too small, because otherwise exactly this effect becomes important. So you have to be in just the right regime for this formula that I'm writing to hold. In principle, you can incorporate the motion. This is something that people do, and you can also generalize it so it holds for larger distances and larger velocities.
Start orbiting another one, you know, so that would change its velocity a lot.
The
star is orbiting another one.
The star can be orbiting
something else, so it's coming at you or going away.
So here I'm really imagining that I'm looking at galaxies as a whole. So these are further out, so I'm not so worried about the individual stars. So the galaxies might themselves also orbit, but there's also a typical few hundred kilometers per second velocities associated with that. So you want to be, as I said, larger. So again, remember that the speed of light is 300,000 kilometers per second. So this would correspond, if I'm saying the typical velocities here are 300 kilometers per second, then this is a redshift of 10 to the minus 3.
So another redshift.
Hey, is this a redshift?
Yeah. Uh-oh.
Not a green shift.
No, this doesn't work anymore, probably.
Really?
Stick, yes.
Yeah. All right. So the redshift, as I said, should be larger than 10 to the minus 3, let's say, 10 to the minus 2 if you want to be safe, and less than 1 for this formula to hold. But in principle, you can correct it in both directions. Any other questions about this? Okay, so then the only other thing I wanted to do in this context is to just show what the current state of the art for the Hubble diagram looks like. So this is what a modern Hubble diagram would look like. And then here it's cut off at 10 to the minus 2 because of the effect we just discussed. So eventually the velocities are larger than the recession velocity. So you don't want to look at it here. There's going to be scatter in that relation. And then here on large redshifts, it's not really showing the formula I showed, but this is why it's showing here the what is called the distance modulus, which is really the luminosity distance, which has additional, it's a somewhat different thing from just the velocity is corrected by the redshift, for example, and has dependence on the cosmology. But so this is current state of the art of the Hubble diagram measured from supernovae, which I briefly mentioned but won't really describe in detail. So this is the kind of diagram that makes us pretty sure that the universe actually is expanding, because you wouldn't get this kind of feature. Hubble's data, I mean, some of the galaxies he was looking at really were very nearby, where you have to exactly worry about the intrinsic motion of these objects. But here we really can look at objects that where we really can trust that they're moving fast enough. You can still try to correct. So some of the scatter is due to this effect. So you can still try to correct for that in principle and reduce the scatter, but this is what it looks like if you just plot it. Okay, so here I wanted to just show you how far we can actually look out into the universe in this way, if you wish. And so here I'm showing you the distance record holder, which has a not too memorable name. It's GNZ11. Actually stands for Goods North, and then Z11 is telling you that the redshift of the object is about 11. So it has some meaning to the name. It tells you where it is and what its redshift is. You can ask how far you're looking in time to that object, and you're seeing that as it was 13.4 billion years ago, or at a time when the universe was 400 million years old. So now you're really looking back in time, and in case you want to find it on the night sky, I put a little animation in it, so you can see the Big Dipper here, and then I think everyone can find the Big Dipper in the night sky, and then eventually we'll zoom in just north of it into the Goods North field, and we'll show you the object. So now it's harder to. But so this is the field, and then this is Hubble data.
Oh my!
Wow.
And so this is the galaxy. redshift 11. So you see this galaxy as it was 13.4 billion years ago. So in this case, you're really looking pretty far back in time. So now that we know that the universe is expanding, we also know that at early times it was significantly denser and hotter, and you could ask if there should be, so eventually there weren't yet any galaxies, but you can ask if there's any radiation left over from this hotter period, and this is exactly the question that Dickey was asking and got Peebles, Roll, and Wilkinson to work on it. So here they're shown on the roof of the Princeton Physics Department, trying to see if they can find any radiation that's left over from a hotter period of the universe. And meanwhile, not too far away from it, so this, I should say, is only really showing Roll and Wilkinson. Jim Peebles, you might know, received the Nobel Prize recently, and then Dickey isn't shown in the picture. Meanwhile, not too far away, just 30 miles away in Holmdel, New Jersey, Penzias and Wilson were not really looking for that signal, but were looking or using a telescope initially with the hope to study our galaxy. And they had the problem that they just had noise in the instrument that they couldn't explain. It was there everywhere they were looking in the sky. They thought maybe it's pigeons. They cleaned out the instrument. It still didn't really go away. So they were seeing the signal and just couldn't understand what was going on. So for them, it was just some excess noise in their antenna. And eventually, Jim Peebles gave a talk that Ken Turner heard, told Bernie Berg, who told Penzias and Wilson, that there's a group at Princeton trying to detect a signal from the early universe that looks essentially like what they were looking at. And so then there were the two papers published back to back by Penzias and Wilson about the measurement of excess antenna temperature, so just noise they couldn't explain, and the interpretation of the signal as cosmic black body radiation by Dickey, Peebles, Roll, and Wilkinson. And now that you made the claim that this is really cosmic black body radiation, radiation that's left over from the hot early universe, you have to somehow understand how this works. Before then, I wanted to just, as a fun fact, if you look at the telescope, you might ask, why was there this telescope around in Holmdel, New Jersey? And I don't know if anyone heard of the Project Echo by NASA. So some people, I guess, know about it.
We remember it.
Yeah, okay.
We saw it in space.
Sorry?
We saw it in space.
Sure.
Okay, the balloons, yeah. So this is what this telescope was initially used for. So the Holmdel telescope was used to receive the signals that were sent from JPL. So this is what the telescope was used for initially. Okay, so now one is trying to understand whether the signal you're seeing really is from the early universe or really is just some noise that you don't understand. So it makes additional predictions that you can try to look for. For example, because the Earth moves around the Sun, the solar system moves in our galaxy moves, it's pretty unlikely that we're at rest with respect to this radiation. And then you expect that the radiation should look a little bit hotter in the direction you're moving and a little bit colder in the direction you're moving away from, a little bit like when you're running in the rain, more drops hit you from the front than from the back. So this kind of effect is what people were looking for very early on. And I'm showing, usually the measurement that I'm showing on the next slide is credited with the detection of the dipole. Here I'm showing a measurement that I really like that detected the dipole, measured the right ascension declination and amplitude. This is a measurement by just a single person, which is pretty remarkable given what the experiments look like now. And so Paul Henry built the instrument, launched the balloon, collected the data, did all the analysis by himself, wrote a single author paper on it. And the fun thing to me is that he was a grad student at the time. So. And so, as I said, the dipole we think of as associated with emotion relative to the cosmic microwave background. And so this measurement tells us the speed with which we're moving relative to the cosmic microwave background. Once you know the temperature, which I'll show in a second, you can really convert it into a velocity. So we this is the measurement that's usually credited. This is a detection at much higher significance by Smoot, who used the same detectors that then flew on a satellite that I'll show in a second. But this is the much higher confidence detection of the dipole of the cosmic microwave background that tells you that we're moving with respect to it, and tells you we're moving with respect to it roughly at 300 kilometers per second. An additional prediction, just like we had a very characteristic spectrum for starlight, is that the cosmic microwave background should have a very characteristic spectrum, and we usually call it a black body spectrum. So this is what's shown here. The black line is the theory curve, and the squares are the data. And so you see that the data and the measurement really agree extremely well. So this is a beautiful measurement of the spectrum of the cosmic microwave background. And so both the frequency spectrum and the motion were detected. And so at that point, presumably you're more convinced that what we're looking at is really cosmic black body radiation. Going forward, I'll show you a lot of maps of the cosmic microwave background. And so I briefly just wanted to show you how they're usually presented or what it would look like to look at the Earth in this projection. It's called the Mollweider projection. And this is just a simple, convenient projection, not unique in any way, but one projection that you can use to map a sphere into the plane. Sometimes when people see it, they think it only really shows half of the sphere, but it really shows the full sphere. That's why I'm showing you the map of the Earth. This is what the Earth would look like in this projection. And we use the same to show the measurements of the cosmic microwave background. Here's what the COBE satellite measured. This was in the early 90s. And the leading piece is quite boring. So this is the black body radiation that we saw. It peaks, or it has a temperature of 2.728 Kelvin is what's here. And then in the orange one, it's probably hard for you to see, but there's a small little departure, so you can barely see the dipole. So once you remove the 2.728 Kelvin, what you're left with is this map. And this has a dipole pattern, so we see that the radiation looks just a little bit hotter in this direction than in this direction, by 3.353 millikelvin, in this case consistent with the 3.2 millikelvin, if you remember from the measurement by Paul Henry. So this is the dipole caused by our motion relative to the cosmic microwave background. If you subtract off the dipole, assuming that it is from the motion, the image that you're left with is this one. And then if you look here, the most noticeable thing is the red part. This is what we usually see as the Milky Way. So this is just our galaxy. And that's the thing that we usually don't want to see when we're doing cosmology, but that's just a prominent feature in the maps. But if you look at high latitudes, you actually do see fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. These fluctuations we expect to be there because eventually, if the universe were completely homogeneous, we also wouldn't be around. So there have to be small fluctuations. These are the fluctuations. And if you take, so COBE had three frequency channels, you can use them to try to minimize the emission from the galaxy, and you can make a map of the fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. This is what the map looked like at the time, and this is a somewhat noisy and low resolution picture, but it is a picture of what the universe looked like when it was 380,000 years old. So you're looking back basically 13 billion years, and this is what the universe looks like at the time. So we can really take a picture because it takes light, light travels at a finite speed, and so it takes a long time for the light that was emitted then to reach us.
Yeah. So can you give us a sense of how much it's actually varying in relative to the actual temperature?
So here I had it on the previous, it was 18 microkelvin for the 53 gigahertz map was the scale that was shown here. So it's typically 1 part in 10 to the 5 or 1 part in 100,000. So the fluctuations are very small. So it's kind of fuzzy, it's here. But it's 1 part in 10 to the 5 are the intrinsic fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background that have been studied since then. And so there have been a number of experiments since then that measure the cosmic microwave background. One was the Wilkinson microwave anisotropy probe. Wilkinson is the Wilkinson we saw earlier on the roof of the physics department in Princeton. And so here you see the satellite, and it's supposed to illustrate where it's located. So it was located or taking the measurement at the second Lagrange point, which means it's behind the Earth and moving around the solar system with the Earth as it's taking its data. So this is the picture, and this is the map that WMAP produced, and you see it's higher resolution, lower noise image of what the universe looked like at 380,000 years old. The most recent full sky measurement is by the Planck collaboration, which was a European experiment by the European Space Agency with contributions by NASA and the US. And this is the map that we got from Planck. Everyone used slightly different color codes, but it's eventually the same kind of thing, just shown in different color codes. And this is our current and essentially the final picture of the universe at 380,000 years old, because the fluctuations we know are really damped on smaller scales. So if you measure it more precisely in intensity, you wouldn't do much better than this. So the picture to your eye would still look the same. The situation is different in polarization, as I'll mention, so there's more to measure there.
So are those structures, or are those just random patterns?
So they are, to a good approximation, they're, as far as we know, they're consistent, the underlying density field is consistent with just random Gaussian fluctuations. And what you're seeing, I'll say a little bit more, but what you're seeing are essentially the density perturbations in the medium at the time. So the universe was hot and dense at that time, so there were electrons, protons interacting, and that medium was slightly over-dense in some parts, slightly under-dense. Here, this image is essentially an image, there's a little bit more physics to it, but essentially an image of the energy density in the photons.
I mean, there's like this big orange swath. Is that a structure, or is that just random chance?
This is random chance, is the claim. So if you run simulations, I didn't include any simulations, but if you generate simulations, you also get structures, obviously not in the same place. In other parts, it looks like this. So it doesn't obviously look like there's some structures there.
Excuse me, is the 380,000 years that you keep showing, is that some limitation on Hubble? Due to some artifact in the Hubble design, or what? So, for example, you pointed out that there was close to 14 billion years was the furthest star. Is that limited by Hubble design, or is there something else there?
So the star, eventually, as you try to look further, there aren't really any stars yet, so you wouldn't see anything. If you go to higher redshift, there's some hope that you can see that period through emission from neutral hydrogen, because the universe is neutral at that time, so you can hope to learn something from 21 centimeter line observations. But as you go back, eventually at high enough redshifts, the universe just becomes ionized, and you can't, so photons last scatter around that time, you can't really see through. So we can't really look further back, because the universe is ionized and the mean free path for photons becomes very small in the early universe. So this is the furthest. This is the 380,000 years.
That's at 380. So
yeah, I mean,
before that, you can't see.
Before that, you can't really see. So there's hope to directly image something from earlier times, not in electromagnetic radiation, but for example, gravitational waves. You would be able to see further back in time. Or also, if you could detect the cosmic neutrino background, which we also think is there, you should also be able to look further back in time. But with electromagnetic radiation, you can't really hope to see further back than this, just because the medium is ionized and the mean free path is very low. It's like a cloud. You also eventually, if you have a cloud in the sky, you can't look beyond that. It's not a perfect analogy.
Can you tell us how large this is? Is it the speed of light at 380,000?
So the size of the dots, I'll say more about that in a second, but the size of the dots is set essentially not quite by the speed of light, but the speed of sound in the hot early universe. So the universe was filled with electrons, protons, they interact with each other electromagnetically. The speed of sound is 1/3 to good approximation times the speed of light, but it's essentially the So the size of these objects, the physical size, is the speed of sound in the medium, which is about 1 over the square root of 3 of this the speed of light, times the age of the universe. It's not entirely true. There are some corrections to these formulas.
How wide is the whole thing?
The whole thing is the full sky. So really imagine you make a map of the full sky. And so we know what the physical size is. I can say more about that. But we know what the physical size of one of these blobs should be. And this tells you how far away this surface is. So from that, we can measure essentially the age of the universe, the curvature of the universe, because we know how big these blobs are in physical size. And that, together with the angular size we measure, allows us to learn something about the distance or the light travel time. So that's one of the main ways. I mean, the characteristic size here that I'll show you more visually is one of the main ways we can actually learn something about the distance to this. Any other questions? Okay, so we can't really hope to predict this map as it is because there are these red blobs here, and no one can hope to have a theory that predicts why there's a red blob over there and there isn't a red blob over there. So the only thing we can hope to predict are really statistical properties of these maps. And so what we do is we look at the angular power spectrum, and I'll try to give you some intuitive feeling for what it is we're actually doing when we're showing the angular power spectrum, which I'll show you in a second. So what the angular power spectrum is trying to measure is how strong are the fluctuations on a given angular scale. To figure that out, you can take the map and you try to get, let's say you're interested in the strength of the fluctuations on 5-degree scales. You will average out everything that's on smaller scales, and then you remove all the information on larger scales. You can do that by taking a map and smoothing it to somewhat larger scales and taking the difference of the two. And then you get a map that looks like this. And I'll show you, so I'll do that for 5 degrees, then I'll show you for different angular scales, and I'll keep the color scale the same for all the maps. And then you will see that the signal at 5 degrees, this is what it looks like. So you see some light blue, you see some orange, but it looks pretty faint. As you go to 1 degree, it looks a lot stronger. So you see that you have some dark blue, some dark red, and this was on the same color scale. So this means the fluctuations that you're seeing on 1 degree are much stronger than the fluctuations on 5 degrees. And you keep going with that exercise. You can go to, let's say, 0.5 degree, and you see that it's getting fainter again, and you can keep going. You can measure it at many different angular scales. You get a measurement like this. So on 5-degree scales, I showed you the map, and you see that it was kind of faint. This was the light orange and light blue map. Then as you go to 1 degree, it was much brighter. That's obviously why I chose 1 degree to show you this feature. Then if you go to 0.5 degree, it gets fainter again. And then as you keep going, it gets fainter and fainter. Maybe because I show a few of these, maybe I'll briefly ask if there's questions about this so it makes sense what I'm showing here.
What's the angular power spectrum?
The angular power spectrum is this figure. So this is just called the angular power spectrum.
Look at the cosmic background, and you've got how much power is in a certain size, or?
Yeah. So you would take the map, get rid of all the information on smaller and larger scales than the scales you're interested in. And look for how strong the signal is there.
How strong it is within 5 degrees.
So you average everything on scales that are smaller than 5 degrees, and you do another map where you average on slightly larger than 5 degrees, subtract. So the only information you have in the map is about 5 degrees.
So this is taken from the Planck data?
I did this from the Planck data, so I haven't actually seen it shown this way. I was trying to show these as an illustration. In practice, this is not how it's really measured. This is just an illustration that shows you visually what's going on. So you could measure the angular power spectrum this way, only keep information on 5 degrees, make the measurement of the power spectrum here. I did that. I mean, just for myself, for entertainment. But that's not how it's usually it's not really how it's usually
done. For their entertainment.
For your entertainment as well. Yeah, also mine. But yeah?
Well, Is there a theory as to the shape of that final curve?
Yeah.
Could you explain what it's that shape?
Yeah, I'll say yes. So that's why we think we understand the early universe quite well, because we have a simple theory that explains it. That theory makes additional predictions that you can test. I'll show that in just a second.
So what's special about 1 degree?
So we'll also see that, but that is the what's telling you the basically that's measuring the position of this. So this is the peak here.
Yeah.
This is telling you essentially about the age of the universe, or how far the surface is away.
I see.
You couldn't know that a priori, so that's not something you can know. That's something you can extract from the data and then learn how old the universe is. So there's nothing intrinsically. So in fact, if you observe the CMB some time from now, you would be looking further out, so the features would be smaller. So the CMB spectrum, if you were to measure it as a function of time, we don't have, you know, you have to wait tens of thousands of years to see this effect, so we can't really do it in practice, but eventually it would get dimmer and shift out, so this is...
If there were another universe somewhere,
yeah,
at the same age as ours, would you get that same shape of curve?
So that depends on the composition of that universe. If that other universe has the same density of atoms, same density of matter, then yes, you would get the same curve.
It would be
there's a priori no reason that if it's a completely different universe, that it has the same composition. But if it had the same composition, you would expect to see the same shape. So I'll say a little bit more about that as well.
Can you explain the secondary peaks?
These peaks?
Yes.
Whether we understand them or whether I can explain them right away.
Your choice.
My choice. Okay, so let me give you a bit of, I didn't include it, but I guess I should have maybe included more of the technical detail. So let me try to say a little bit about the underlying physics that you're actually seeing here. So what you're seeing, so I don't have slides on this, but so let me just explain what the different peaks are. So as we said, the universe is hot and dense. It's made of electrons and protons, photons. So there's a plasma that supports sound waves. So you can have density perturbations in that medium. And you can think of it as a superposition of standing waves for a second. That's a good approximation for this picture. So the different scales we're looking at here then correspond to different wavelengths of the standing waves. And if you have sound waves, they always, I mean, it's a basic, it's based on symmetries, they have a dispersion relation that's linear. So if you have longer sound waves, they will oscillate more slowly.
Is it just resonant frequencies then?
Essentially, so you have frequencies, so they all start oscillating with some amplitude, then you have a set of wavelengths that have just the right wavelength to shift up to get to the maximum by the time the universe becomes neutral. That's this wavelength that you're seeing here. Then as you go to somewhat shorter wavelengths, the modes oscillate a little bit faster, and so there's another set of wavelengths where the mode makes it up and back down. You get, this is squared, so this is a power spectrum, this is squared. So this is, the second peak is the mode that oscillates by 2 pi, or that makes one oscillation. Then you have another one that makes it up, down, and up again, so that's the third peak, and so on. And we've seen 7 of these peaks, so we think that that's the correct physics. That's the basic physics, so what you're looking at are these kind of sound waves.
The harmonics?
Yeah.
But meanwhile, the universe is expanding. Isn't that going to screw things up, the standing waves?
So the universe becomes neutral for all of them at the same time. So the universe becomes neutral pretty quickly when it reaches a temperature of about 3,000 Kelvin, just because protons and electrons form hydrogen. And from then on, the photons just propagate to us. So they're... That's not entirely true. Eventually you have star formation, there's some free electrons that scatter, and so this suppresses the power spectrum a little bit, but to a good approximation, they just free stream. Yeah?
So standing waves implies reflection?
reflection. So here I think there's no reflection. I mean, so imagine a universe that's infinite. So you're imagining pinning them at the ends, and then you have...
Aren't you usually have reflection with standing waves?
If you have boundaries, I guess. So here there's no boundaries. So just imagine an infinite universe for the second.
You're traveling in that case. It's a case.
It doesn't necessarily have to travel. So you can still write, decompose it in terms of these waves. Okay, so I only really described it in very minimal detail, but so we have a theory that describes the medium, and so if you compare the theory to the data, it really allows us to measure the composition, the geometry, and age of the universe, and it turns out that the model that fits the data is very simple, so all you need to know is that 5% of the energy density today is stored in atoms, 30% of the energy today is in matter. The universe is flat to a very good approximation, and it's about 13.8 billion years old. So this is what follows from the peak positions. And this, I mean, here obviously there's more parameters that you have to know if you want to do all the calculations. Those we usually take from lab experiments. For example, the properties of hydrogen we take from lab experiments. We assume that there's three species of neutrinos, and this is something that in principle you can test, so you can independently constrain them from the data, and you find that it's 2.99 plus minus 0.17. So that's consistent with what we know from the lab. And so here I'm just trying to give you a brief visual idea of which parts of the spectrum constrain what. So as I briefly explained, the peak position constrains the age of the universe and the curvature, just because we know how far these sound waves really can travel from the beginning of when the medium, the universe is first filled with this medium until the universe becomes neutral, and then from how big they look in the sky, we know how far away it is, what the age is. Then from the magnitude here, we can measure the matter density. The more matter there is, the deeper the gravitational potentials, and so the larger the fluctuations. Here I'm just indicating the first and the second peak, but it's really the difference between the even and odd peaks that allows you to measure the density of atoms. And then the number of neutrinos you can measure from how fast the spectrum here damps as you go to smaller scales. So you can really learn a lot about the composition of the medium at the time from looking at the power spectrum. So this is, you might say, well, but maybe there's some other theory that also kind of fits these. Maybe I can just fit a polynomial to it if you work hard enough. How do we really know that this is what's going on? And the theory makes additional predictions that we can test. So for example, we expect the cosmic microwave background to be polarized. So, and that's also something we can measure. So briefly, let me just say, you might all have, might be familiar with polarized sunglasses or how they're supposed to work. So the basic idea is that say the sun is somewhere up here, you're looking at a mountain, the light scatters off the snow and you see it. If you have unpolarized sunglasses or just no sunglasses, you will see a glare from the scattering. And it turns out that if that light is polarized transverse to the direction, to the plane in which the scattering occurs. So if it scatters like this, the light would be polarized in this direction. And so you can take a polarization filter that only lets polarization through in this direction. This would completely block out the glare and you get a clearer picture. So that's the basic idea of the polarized sunglasses. And if you wanted to, you can also turn your sunglasses around and maximize the glare, if that's something you like. This is essentially what we do for the cosmic microwave background. We try to find out in which direction is the glare or the polarization maximal. So we're measuring the polarization angle and the intensity. And so briefly, why do we think it's polarized? So if you have a hot medium, so this is, let's say, the photon bath in the early universe, and you have some electrons here, if it's homogeneous, you have the same temperature everywhere, you might say, okay, I have some photons that scatter this electron from this direction, it comes out and we see it. then the scattering plane is this plane. It's polarized perpendicular to it, so we expect some polarization for that scattering event. But there's the same number of photons that come from this direction, and so the net effect is that the radiation for a homogeneous medium is expected to be zero. This changes if you have a quadrupole, so you have some hotter region and a colder region and a hotter region, because in that case you get more photons from the right that scatter off the electron and lead to a polarization, a vertical polarization. Then you have photons that scatter from the colder region and lead to the horizontal polarization, and so you get a net polarization that's vertical in this. So if you have a temperature quadrupole, and we saw that there's temperature fluctuations, I should really motivate why there's a quadrupole, which I'm not going to do, but I'm happy to explain if people want to understand better afterwards. But if there's a quadrupole, you expect net polarization of the cosmic microwave background, and this is something we can look for. And in particular, you can, in the model, you can calculate what that should look like. And what it should look like, according to the model, is the red curve. This is the model just based on the temperature data I showed you before. And then you plot the data on it. This data is not fit to the red curve. The red curve is the prediction. And you see that you got the physics correct. I mean, this it would be a coincidence. So if you just fit the temperature data with your polynomial, then I'm pretty sure this this part won't come out okay. So that's the way you can predict. The other way we can be sure, there's a lot of physics in here that if anyone is interested in more detail, I can explain the features here more. But the basic upshot here was just that the theory really predicts this and is in good agreement with what we see. Another thing is you could ask, well, does it predict the late universe, the simple model? If you run it forward in time, does it look like our universe at late times? And it turns out that if you do this exercise, it does really form the kind of filamentary structure that we see in galaxy redshift surveys. So everything that we know seems consistent, with the exception of this small tension in the Hubble parameter, where right now the value that's predicted by the cosmic microwave background measurements is somewhat lower than the value that's inferred from the local Hubble measurements. So that's a tension or difference. That's interesting, but overall I think the zeroth order picture is that this basic cosmology describes our universe remarkably well with just a few parameters. Now, these are the kind of quantitative things where you can use it to measure the matter density, density of atoms. There's also some qualitative things that we learn about it that are perhaps even more fascinating. One of them, or this is usually referred to as the horizon problem. So here this is supposed to be the satellite that measures the cosmic microwave background. This is our map. And you see that the temperature is 2.7255, so this is the last measurement from COBE, 2.7255 Kelvin everywhere in the sky. So you would think that somehow there must have been some communication. Otherwise, it's unclear why the universe should have the same temperature in all directions in the sky. So this is a comic I came across that looked somewhat related to me. So So if you see everyone asking for 43 cents, presumably they must have known of each other. So that's the basic idea here for the horizon problem. And in the model we have, you can ask whether the different regions in the sky actually had a way to communicate with each other. And it turns out, according to the model that I just presented to you, they really didn't have a chance to communicate. The universe just isn't old enough. So according to our little model, we shouldn't expect the cosmic microwave background to look this homogeneous. We should expect much larger fluctuations. That's the first puzzle. This puzzle kind of gets worse because you can also look at the temperature anisotropies. And here I was describing for you the sound waves and the phases. And it turns out that the spectrum we're looking at, it tells us that for whatever reason, the phases of the oscillations in this part of the sky are the same as the phases in this part of the sky. So it's not just the temperature, but they're also all oscillating with the same phase. And that also suggests that some process must have set up the phases, so they really are the same in all directions. If that wasn't the case, if you had local processes, then again you would expect different phases in a spectrum that looks very different. So it shouldn't have the nice peak structure that we saw. You can go further and look at the polarization measurements If anyone is really interested, because some of you had quite technical questions, so if anyone is more interested, I can describe this in more detail later. But the polarization measurements provide additional evidence for this phase coherence. And at least in the context of Einstein's general relativity, this requires the only way to really get these different parts or to set up these kind of perturbations in a causal way in general relativity is either through accelerated expansion, which is usually called inflation, or through a decelerated contracting phase of the universe. We know that this is not the phase we live in, so in this phase, you have to somehow bounce and make it out on the other side into a universe that's expanding. So these are the two basic options. The one that's expanding is really the one that's predominantly studied, but those are the two basic options. And here the idea is that the early universe underwent a period of nearly exponential expansion where during the first 10 to the minus 33 seconds, it expanded by 30 orders of magnitude. So a tremendous expansion. And then it's easy to see that if you have a small patch initially, it gets blown to a huge size. And really, we see the same temperature everywhere in the sky because it came from one and the same little region early on. So that's how it would explain the temperature perturbations. In addition, if you have such a period, so where you have a nearly exponential expansion, we know that we don't live in that period, so the universe has to have some clock. It has to know how to end this period. And according to quantum mechanics, so I'm not really deriving any of these, but according to quantum mechanics, there should be small fluctuations in this clock, which means that the universe would end this expansion slightly earlier in some parts and slightly later in other parts. And so you get small ripples in this. And the idea is that the fluctuations we see here are really the result of these quantum fluctuations in the clock that's telling the universe when to end inflation. And this is why I was calling the talk our quantum universe, because the idea is that the quantum fluctuations here get are the source for the fluctuations we see in the cosmic microwave background. They get processed through the plasma physics that I briefly described, and then eventually from these tiny fluctuations, the stars and galaxies we see around us grow. All of it from the quantum fluctuations in this clock. So you might say, well, there might be, as I said, there's potentially other theories that could explain this. There's open questions in inflation. We don't fully understand how it began. This is something we've been spending a fair amount of time on, as Mark said, in the context. I mean, we've been working on this this modern inflation collaboration. So in that context, we've been thinking about how inflation might have gotten started, for example. But the one thing I think everyone agrees is that inflation, in addition to the fluctuations in the clock, also predicts quantum fluctuations in space-time itself. So there should be small ripples in space-time, and they lead to a very characteristic polarization pattern in the cosmic microwave background that one can also look for. It's not something that you would confuse with the things we've seen before, although you might confuse it with dust from the Milky Way. So there's that problem. But in principle, if you measure it at multiple frequencies, it has a different frequency dependence. So here I'm showing you everything in one figure because I'm showing you just also how far the measurements have come. So remember that the CMB temperature is 2 Kelvin or 2.7255 Kelvin. These fluctuations were the 18 microkelvin that we were seeing. These are up here. By now, we've gone orders of magnitude below and mapped part of the E-mode spectrum, not yet the small tail. And we're trying to get down to these gravitational waves. Here are the most recent measurements for this, or upper limits on this. And so people have really pushed the sensitivity of the experiments way down. The goal is to get to nanokelvin. So from Kelvin, where initially the CMB was detected, down to nanokelvin. So this is the next set of experiments. Here is the current, essentially the largest signal that's currently allowed. This already ruled out some models, but really the search is just getting started, and over the next decade or so, we'll try to push the measurements down to about the level that I'm showing here with several experiments. So here are the experiments that are taking data right now. This is the Bicep Keck was the collaboration that reported the measurement that turned out to be essentially dust, SPT. Mm-hmm. Then Polar Bear, you might gather that this presumably was not always meant to be in the Atacama Desert, but so here you have Polar Bear in the Atacama Desert. And then there's Advanced Ag Class. Several experiments are taking data right now. Some of these are already done. And then as we go forward, relatively soon, there should be Simons Observatory. It was initially started relatively small. By now, there's a long list of groups that are working on it. This is not showing the experiment. This is just showing the site where it will be. This is the ACT. This is the Polar Bear Simons Array. And this is the CMB S4 if you go further. So this is an experiment where essentially the entire CMB community in the US will join and operate from two sites. One is in Chile, in the Atacama Desert. The other one is at the South Pole. And there's also an experiment that was recently selected by JAXA in Japan. It's called Lightbird. And these experiments will push the limits down to essentially what I was showing. The launch should be in 2028. So over the next decade or so, we'll really learn a lot about the inflationary part. But of course, they will also really tell us a lot more about other aspects of the universe. For example, they will measure the content age that we already discussed to even higher precision. And here in this picture that I like, you also see that you can map the matter density in this way, because the photons from the cosmic microwave background to reach us have to make their way through stars and galaxies. They're slightly deflected, and this effect has been detected at high significance, so you can actually make maps of the matter along the line of sight from this. You can also map the hot gas in galaxies from this, just because the photons interact with the hot gas. They get heated a little bit. It causes a spectral distortion away from the nice black body that I was showing earlier that can be detected. It constrains particles beyond the standard model. So there's really a lot that we're hoping to learn from these experiments. What we're not really going to learn about from the experiments all that much is the kind of thing we were thinking about during the program here that was called From Inflation to the Hot Big Bang. So here the question was how inflation ends and how the universe becomes filled with the hot and dense plasma. That's something that we've been thinking about. It's less clear how you experimentally test this area, but still interesting to think about, speculate about exactly how that should work and see if you can actually think of some experimental consequences of it. Just to conclude, as I explained, so we're looking out into the universe really allows us to look back in time. So essentially by taking more and more data to higher redshift, we really see how the universe evolved because we're looking back in time. The earliest light we can see, as I also mentioned, because eventually the universe is ionized, the earliest light we can see is radiation that's left over directly from the hot early universe, and this radiation is the cosmic microwave background that I described. The observations, this really constrain the composition, age, geometry of the universe to good precision. Right now, to about 1%, we'll do significantly better with the upcoming experiments. And as far as we know, they really reveal that the universe is very simple. So it only takes a few parameters to describe what we see out there. And we also saw, or I briefly argued for you, that the properties that we see in the CMB, the fact that it's so homogeneous, 2.7255 Kelvin over the full sky, and that the phases of the oscillations are the same everywhere in the sky, really means that there has to have been some earlier period that generated these perturbations. In principle, this might have, if it's inflation, you would expect that it generated some level of space-time fluctuations as well that one can look for in the cosmic microwave background, and that's something we're currently actively working on. And so if you have questions about any of the experiments, you can ask me more about it. And hopefully, with the help of these experiments, we'll learn a lot more about the first fractions of our universe and also the later parts. So
okay.
That's...
Thank you.
It seems to me the description of CMB, it seems like it's an absolute frame of reference.
Yeah, it does provide a frame of reference.
Thank you. absolute parameter. How's that mesh with special relativity?
In special relativity, you usually assume that there really isn't anything in the space-time, and then there's no preferred frame. But as soon as you have a medium, if you have a fluid or some other medium, you have a frame because there's a special frame where you see the same number of photons going this way as you see going that way, or with the same velocities. As soon as you have a medium, there's a preferred frame. So in some sense, there is an ether. Right? It's the cosmic microwave in the background.
So when you talk about,
when the gravitational waves are detected, there was the speculation this would be a great insight into the earliest times before the threshold. Yeah. Has that happened?
No, it didn't happen. Fortunately, that hasn't happened. So if you detect this signal, then you really learn something about the period of inflation that I described. No, hasn't happened because the measurement at the time really turned out to be just a measurement of dust. So it's not, we didn't see the signal, unfortunately.
So have there been any considerations of perhaps using magnetic lenses to understand what's happening in the ionized area? So in other words, clearly if you have magnetic fields, you can take a look at structure. And that's what people do in the fusion activity, uh-huh, using tokamaks and whatnot. So if everything is ionized, you would think that magnetic fields could be utilized to try to understand the structure of the ions.
Yeah, so we do that at some level at later time. So the kind of work we've been doing on understanding the interstellar medium, understanding how the dust grains emit and so on, in that part we use magnetic fields because the dust grains trace the magnetic field line. So you use techniques like this at later times, not really for the early time.
What would prevent you from trying to understand the structure by looking at the magnetic manifolds and things like that?
So we don't really think that there are large-scale magnetic fields present at that time. And then the other magnetic fields, so the short, high-frequency ones that we see are just the photons that we're actually observing. Okay. So that's the information that we're trying to use. The other ones would be large-scale magnetic fields that don't really seem to be present.
Okay, let's think about that.